Second case set for oral argument today is case number A18-1130, Proactive Imaging LLC versus Peters and others. Counsel, I think both parties know that you have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and appellant's counsel has an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for appellant, you may begin. Please state your name before beginning your argument.
Good morning. My name is Scott Johnson, and I represent the appellants, Dr. Gail Tash and Clarence Ramsey. I know that this court reads these briefs very carefully. I'm going to just focus in on 4 points that I think merit and I think mandate reversal of this fee sanction assessed against our clients. Normally, under Rule 37, of course, assessment of fees is a discretionary call with a trial judge, no question about that. But discretionary calls are reversed on a regular basis by this court and the Supreme Court if there's been an abuse of that discretion. The applicable rule here is that there's been an erroneous view of the law being Rule 26 of the Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure and Rule 401 of Evidence, as well as a misconstruing of the elements of aiding and abetting, which were essentially ignored by the trial court in her ruling. And that, which is, I thank God, because that was all that was really left of the case after she dismissed the legal malpractice claim. So first, the abuse of discretion for erroneous view of the law. Rule 401 of Evidence, of course, defines what is relevant. It has no exception contained within it for an incident where somebody might make an admission in a deposition, somehow rendering that evidence no longer relevant. It simply doesn't say anything like that at all. Neither does Rule 26 of the Rules of Civil Procedure, which allows evidence to be discovered, have an exception if there's been an admission made along the way by someone. What strikes me as very unusual in this case, and I say this entering my 39th year of trying cases in this district, I've never before had a trial court say during the pretrial discovery period, you know, I think you've gathered enough evidence on that particular issue, I'm not going to let you gather any more. I've never heard of that. It's not, there was no authority provided by the court in her memorandum for that, and I think that's a fundamental error that makes her ruling reversible on an abuse of discretion.
Well, what about at page 5 of the order, the district court cites Rule 2602B3 for the statement that discovery must be limited if the court finds that it is unreasonably cumulative or duplicative. Isn't that authority for limiting? Just something that's logically relevant. At some point, there are some outer limits on what is discoverable, and that's where the district court was operating here, and there is some authority there, isn't it?
There is, but I think it's clearly an erroneous construction of that rule for this reason. We'd never sought any billing records before. There was nothing duplicative of what we were seeking at all. To say that written records of the law firm are somehow duplicative of a comment that one of the lawyers makes in a deposition, I think, is unsupportable.
So if this was, and I understand it's not, but if this was in response to a request for admission about the attorney's knowledge that the company had been subject to legal claims in the past, wouldn't you agree in that situation it would be very appropriate for the district court to say, you've got your admission, you don't get to go and do discovery to prove what they've admitted to?
But your question goes right to the heart of our argument and of the reason why this should be reversed. The court continued to focus on direct fraud in her ruling and in the comments from the bench that she made. She kept talking about us having a direct claim for fraud against Tim Peters. As an aside, although our case is over for the reasons that we indicate in our footnote, I think a good case could be made that a lawyer who inserts a knowingly false litigation representation in a purchase agreement should be subject to claims for direct fraud himself, but that's not before you. To answer your question directly, the court kept erroneously looking at this through the prism of direct fraud. We cited to her in our brief, two of our briefs, as well as oral argument, that we're talking about aiding and abetting the fraud of Mr. Bartner. Those are different elements. One of them is knowledge of Mr. Bartner's fraud, for sure. But the other one, which is equally important under the Weitzman decision and the Richard Anderson decision, which are cases involving professionals that have been tied in to some sort of a scheme, and therefore they've aided and abetted their client's misconduct. The second half of aiding and abetting is lending substantial assistance to the tortfeasor. It's a critical. If we don't prove that, we don't get to first base with a jury. We have to show not only that Bartner defrauded, and he admitted in his deposition that he did. At the end of the deposition, we quoted it in our reply brief. He admitted that paragraph 16 was false. But in addition to that, we have to show that Tim Peters lent substantial assistance. The Weitzman case and the Anderson case make it clear that the way you prove that is to look at the extent. In Richard Anderson, the language was the extent to which the professional participated in the wrongful tortious conduct. So it's a quantitative analysis. It's a question of what's the quantum of proof that you have. Was it a case where the professional only met once with the client and then attended the closing? Or, as the billing records could show, were there numerous telephone conversations? Were there multiple drafts of that fraudulent purchase agreement sent back and forth to the client? Was the client billed for multiple drafts? All of that is directly germane to the question of whether Mr. Peters and his law firm were involved in some way. Without that proof, all you have is evidence that Bartner committed fraud. He admitted he did. We settled that case with Mr. Bartner and Mr. Soto, but this is a different case. I hope that addresses your question. It's critical because throughout her ruling, she kept saying that the admission's been made now by Mr. Peters, which, by the way, he recanted later in the same deposition, and which he recanted in an affidavit. He's been all across the board in what he said about what he really knew. But whether he'd admitted it unequivocally, even if he had, all the time, as your honors know, all the time witnesses change their mind and decide at trial that maybe they're going to testify a different way. And so, of course, you have to impeach them by prior inconsistent statements, but you still have your burden to prove your case. And there's nothing in the rules that says that an attorney is limited to just one bit of evidence to prove a fact.
So the district court seemed to go back, I think, looking at your complaint, which talks about knowing these statements are false, concealing the fraud and misrepresentation, knowing the statements were material. It doesn't, or maybe I've just missed it, talk about substantially assisting. It doesn't go into as much detail on that.
Well, we plead in the complaint that he aided and abetted the fraud. So it is pled, and the court acknowledged in her ruling that aiding and abetting was the cause of action left in the case, and that's why it's clearly erroneous for her later, a page later in the same ruling, to say this admission by Mr. Peters takes out of the case. Any other evidence relating to those time records, and it clearly doesn't. We, like I said, we have the burden of showing the extent to which the Peters firm, maybe they were meeting four, five, six times just before that fraudulent purchase agreement had been sent to our clients. We don't know. Those time records, as you know, in a conspiracy case, time and billing records, which are usually generated before there's been any knowledge that a lawsuit might get started, they're worth their weight in gold.
But didn't he admit that he had drafted, that he was the drafter?
Yes, he admitted that he drafted it. And that's an important fact.
Well, he admitted he knew, and he admitted he drafted it. I'm just trying to figure out what more time records are going to show you kind of to get to the substantially assist when he admitted he drafted the language.
Right, and his position is that he drafted language which meant that, I find this astonishing, which meant that there's been no litigation against this clinic that's available, except those that are available for public viewing or something to that effect in his affidavit, which made no sense and has nothing to do with the language of paragraph 16K. Yes, he did draft it. That's an important fact, then, him lending assistance. But, of course, they would argue that, well, that's what a lawyer does. A lawyer just drafts contracts for their clients, and you can't hold them liable under some sort of aiding and abetting standard just for having done that. No, it's the telephone calls, it's the meetings, it's the billing for how many drafts of that were sent to the client, were any sent to him. That's at least discoverable, and I submit very relevant to whether substantial assistance was lent, and certainly shouldn't be cut off by the court during the discovery phase of the case. The court acted as if that fact had been established. I think she even used that word from the bench once. No facts have been established prior to the trial. The jury hasn't been convened yet. I mean, Mr. Peters, without question, would probably recant what he said again. He'd recanted several things he said under oath. No facts have been established until you actually get a jury and you try the case. And I think it's improper for a trial court to cut off what is clearly discoverable evidence on the substantial assistance issue. Just because you might have some other evidence or an admission that later was recanted. Nothing in the rules provides that, and I submit that should be clear error.
I think what you're arguing isn't that nothing in the rules allows it. I think you're arguing, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seems, as I construe your argument anyway, that you're saying that there is a rule that would allow for the district court to limit discovery, but that the basis for that rule hasn't been met. There's not actual cumulative evidence of a particular fact.
Right. I think that's a more, that's a more precise way of saying what I am trying to convey. Absolutely. That, first of all, there's nothing duplicative. We never sought. I understand what sometimes lawyers pile on. Sometimes they keep asking for the same thing, the same documents over and over again, or it gets burdensome or whatever. The courts clearly have, under the rules, discretion to cut it off if somebody's being oppressed or whatever. We're talking about 12 pages of billing records that could be accessed with the push of a computer button. They didn't even argue seriously that there was any burden to it. And for the court to say, this is the illogical part, I make the argument that the court's ruling was also illogical, because to rule that the evidence should not be admitted, it's no longer relevant, because it duplicates other relevant evidence, is illogical. If something is relevant, evidence that duplicates it would, of course, also be relevant. And so the final point I want to make is that the court did not even discuss the substantial justification element. She found on the very last page of her ruling that she just concluded there's no substantial justification. And we cited the Minnesota authority, which relied on Pierce v. Underwood, a U.S. Supreme Court case, that the standard in Minnesota is it basically justified to a reasonable person? It's a reasonable person kind of, is it reasonable in law and fact for someone to ask for these documents? And the court did no analysis of that at all in her ruling. And I think just common sense tells you that if you're in a conspiracy case like this, and you're looking for evidence that links the two parties, the tortfeasor and the lawyer, like billing records would, it's a reasonable request. It's not burdensome. It's not out of bounds. And to sanction our client $5,000 in attorney's fees for requesting them, and then a month later dismiss the case by summary judgment because not enough evidence had been presented to her, she said, of Mr. Peters' participation in the fraud, the very documents we were looking for that could have tended to prove that. And for that reason, unless the court has other questions, I'll stand down.
Just to be clear, the only issue in this appeal is the attorney fees that were shifted.
That's correct. Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Rhett McSweeney, Your Honor, for Timothy Peters and the Peters Law Firm. This case is before the court on one simple issue, whether or not Judge Vassily abused her discretion in awarding attorney's fees when she found the motion to be without any merit, any use, any possible way of providing any evidence that a jury could use to render a judgment against my client, and she was spot on in deciding that no, it wasn't. And she had given counsel plenty of opportunities to know that she was leaning in that direction prior to them bringing their motion.
Mr. McSweeney, would you agree that what we're really talking about here are 12 pages of billing records?
There was no production. I'm not going to agree to that.
I just want to know your position on that.
Yeah, my position is there was never anything produced. We don't know to the extent to what would have been produced had the order gone in a different direction.
But it's some quantity of billing pages. We're not in a position to say how many is what you're saying.
Correct, Your Honor.
You're not arguing that it was burdensome.
I'm not, Your Honor. What I am saying is that the judge made perfectly clear that Mr. Peters acknowledged that he was aware of the AAA litigation prior. Counsel can argue ad nauseum that he never made that admission. He never contradicted that he made that admission. Counsel berated and barraged him to get that claims and litigation were somehow the same thing. And my client's position always was litigation is litigation, claims are claims. He has been consistent and resolute throughout that he was aware of the AAA litigation. At no time did he ever deviate from the fact that he was aware of the AAA litigation or that, as you pointed out, he drafted the paragraph in question that said there was no pending litigation at the time that it was drafted. And the court made clear that it was resolved, that the court had acknowledged that the litigation had been resolved. Therefore, there was no pending litigation at the time that the statement was made. If Mr. Peters says and admits that the sky is blue, counsel doesn't need to bring in experts on color to determine, in fact, Mr. Peters had a reasonable understanding as to what the color blue was. Mr. Peters, at every time he was asked, acknowledged he was aware of the AAA litigation. What counsel sought in, from the very start in a case that had very dubious merit to begin with and was dismissed almost in its entirety early on, was left with an aiding and abetting complaint. And in that single and sole count, the elements that he sought in this discovery were already admitted. As you stated in a request for admission, had there been a request for admission, Mr. Peters, were you aware of the AAA litigation? He would have answered in the affirmative. That was not the course that they took. They took a motion to compel, which had little or no factual basis, had no ability to provide a jury with any substantive information that would aid them in reaching a conclusion. He sought the motion anyway, and Judge Vasily said, this is a waste of my time, this is a waste of the defendant's time, this is a waste of everybody's time, and offered sanctions accordingly.
But, counsel, I do want to ask you about this, what substantially assisted, because I was puzzled by the district courts not focusing on that. You know, whether this was cumulative or relevant if we're looking at whether Peters substantially assisted or encouraged. So could you talk about why, you know, the fact that if someone perhaps, I'm not saying he did, have, you know, 6 meetings or 18 phone calls right, you know, the 2 days before this contract was sent to the other party, wouldn't that tend to show that there was more substantial assistance than just we know he drafted it?
I don't really think that if he talked about knowing about the AAA litigation 77 times or one time, it has any difference in whether or not he was aware of it at the time that the contract was drafted. They've argued that this cumulative evidence of him knowing about the litigation is somehow important seems ridiculous to me. Either you were aware of it or you weren't. And in every instance when he was posed the question of whether or not he was aware of it, he answered in the affirmative. To argue that somehow he may recant, it wouldn't be hard to paint him as being utterly ridiculous when he admitted knowing about it and the evidence had shown that he had been provided documentation on it prior that he admitted receiving.
So you're not, okay, I just want to be clear on this. So you would agree that the evidence sought is not irrelevant. Your argument is only that it is cumulative.
I would argue that it's irrelevant to the point that what's the relevance of another piece of evidence that shows that Mr. Peters was aware of the AAA litigation?
When you say what's the relevance of another piece, it sounds like you're arguing that it's inadmissible or it can be the discovery can be quashed because it's cumulative, not because it's irrelevant.
I would agree. Yes, it was cumulative and it was unnecessary.
But relevant.
the relevance was met at the point that Mr. Peters had admitted.
But it was still relevant. Had he not admitted it, it would be admissible, you're saying.
Had he not admitted it and there was a dispute as to whether or not Mr. Peters was aware of the AAA litigation, I certainly would believe that at that point, evidence to show that what he was contending was false would be relevant.
So the evidence is relevant, and you're saying that, so then you would acknowledge that when the judge based the decision on relevance, that would be erroneous, perhaps supported, the decision supported by a cumulative basis, but not irrelevance.
I think that once it's admitted, it's irrelevant. That the fact
how does that make sense? Once you have an admission, the evidence that supports the admission is irrelevant?
Well, the evidence that supported the admission was Mr. Peters' deposition testimony.
I understand that. I guess we're just, I don't want to waste the time in your argument quibbling over semantics, but there seems to be a real difference between what is cumulative and what is irrelevant. And your argument seems to weave between the two, and the district court's decision seems to use a term relevance when you're saying that it was supported based upon cumulativeness.
It may be a semantic argument, Your Honor. I would suggest that the relevance of any information that went to prove that Mr. Peters was aware of the AAA litigation when there was no evidence contesting the fact that he was.
What about the extent of his involvement? Is that not relevant?
That's not relevant, Your Honor. Judge Vasily discussed that in arguments, in meetings, in briefings at the time that the original motion was heard, which isn't being appealed. There just is no basis for, if he's already admitted the underlying fact, what is the relevance to find more information to support an admission of an already established underlying fact?
Again, it seems like you're making an argument about cumulativeness. If you're saying once it's admitted, why is more evidence relevant? I think what you're saying is why is more evidence necessary?
I would agree that why is more evidence necessary? Why are parties being burdened to produce evidence that doesn't have any use?
That gets back to the original point, I guess, that Judge Justin was asking about, which was, you know, when you say why are parties burdened, are you suggesting that there is somehow a burden on your client in producing billing records?
I'm saying that when you're in litigation and there's a dispute, and issues have been resolved, and there's no need to continue to hammer home a point that's already been made, it's unnecessary to continue discovery on an issue that's already been discovered. If what we're trying to find out is whether or not Mr. Peters was aware of the AAA litigation, we've already discovered that. Discovery is completed on that issue.
Right, I think appellants are arguing that it's not just the awareness, but it's the extent of participation.
And the extent of participation is, was he aware that there was AAA litigation, and did he draft the document?
Do you agree that extent of participation is a relevant issue?
I do not. I don't think the extent or knowledge of how much he knew about the AAA litigation, whether he went home at night and thought about it for 24 hours a day, whether that had any bearing at all on the case. It was whether or not he was aware of it, and he's admitted as much. He's never recanted or refuted the fact that he was aware of the AAA litigation. Any argument by
possibility that he might recant, if you acknowledge that's relevant, why would a party be limited to rely upon the admission of an opponent before trial without being able to be armed with evidence and circumstances that might be used for impeachment purposes should that individual recant at trial?
I don't know that you can get a much stronger bit of rebuttal evidence than a sworn to statement that he had in his deposition. And we can go through the deposition transcript and you'll see at no point, and he was asked on it numerous times, did he ever recant having knowledge of the AAA litigation. Counsel tried to spin it around to make the AAA litigation into a claim, but that wasn't the case. It was AAA litigation. And I think that my client would have looked awful foolish at trial had he tried to recant what he had admitted to on numerous occasions. And they could have used a request for admission as another piece of evidence to support their proof and use for impeachment if necessary. But what they were seeking was evidence that didn't have any bearing on the case. And Judge Vasily rightfully saw that. She made a decision. I don't think there's any evidence that it was clearly erroneous or that she abused her discretion.
What were the bases on which the district court granted summary judgment?
Summary judgment isn't being appealed, Your Honor.
Well, I understand, but I'm just wondering what those issues were, because that has bearing on the gathering of evidence in the discovery phase.
Judge Vasily said that in the granting of summary judgment that the Peters Law Firm was aware of the AAA litigation, that at the time that the AAA litigation, that the statements were made in the document in the contract, that it had been resolved and had been acknowledged by the district court, and that therefore, because you couldn't meet any of those legs of their claims, the rest of their claim failed.
I'm sorry, what was the missing element that was for which there was no evidence?
And the aiding and abetting claim? That it was a knowingly false statement, that they knowingly participated in a scheme to defraud their client. That they knew that the statement in the disclosure was knowingly false, that there was no pending litigation against the underlying entity Proactive. And that because it had been settled, acknowledged by the court that it was settled, that there was no evidence that was knowingly false.
Was that a reliance issue?
No, it wasn't a reliance. There was no aiding, there was no abetting, there was no intent to defraud. If there are no other questions, I'll yield my time.
Thank you, Mr. McSweeney. Counsel for appellant, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
First, to address Your Honor's question about the 12 pages, the trial court erred in that regard too, because she in her ruling said we've been seeking 3.5 years of billing records. We had stipulated with counsel that we would reduce that to 1 year, 12 months worth of billing records. That's why we say we're looking for 12 documents. Again, we're sort of back to the same point that Mr. Peters, we included in our addendum at addendum 20 copies of the deposition of Mr. Peters, where he later, after admitting he was aware of the existence of the AAA litigation, then I asked him, now keep in mind that paragraph 16K, the critical fraudulent paragraph that was inserted, talks about no claims of a legal or equitable nature have ever been asserted against this clinic. That's the language Mr. Peters drafted. And I asked him, question, you knew before April 30 of 2013 there had been a legal claim asserted against Minnesota Radiology, right? Mr. Peters answered, no, there had been a lawsuit initiated against Minnesota Radiology. And I asked him, well, how can a lawsuit not be a legal claim? He said, there are two different things in this context, counsel, and maybe you're not a transactional lawyer, but it's very simple. What this clause says is that there's no litigation pending and there are no claims that have been threatened to the company that may result in litigation, which is important to a buyer when he's buying the stock or the membership units. Again, that's a total distortion of what that paragraph says, but you can see in a prior affidavit, which we include in our record, he swore to the court that he had never reviewed the pleadings relating to the AAA, never looked at any of the pleadings. And then, as we pointed out, once we subpoenaed the billing records of the Lockridge, Grindel, Nowen firm, we found that he had requested the pleadings and they'd been sent to him, and he admitted in the deposition that he had reviewed the summary judgment pleadings. So the point I'm making is that the truth has always been a bit of an elusive concept to Mr. Peters, and he's been all around the block on what he knew and didn't know.
Let's see if I understand your argument. Just so you're not disputing the summary judgment decision, it's not itself being challenged.
That's right.
So if the district court credits the affidavit statement admitting, Mr. Peters admitting the knowledge of the claim, you're saying it may be so that this evidence wouldn't have helped you had you gotten it, but at the time it was justified, you were your client was justified in seeking the evidence.
No, it'd be very relevant to the second half of aiding and abetting, to the extent to which there was substantial assistance lent by the law firm to Mr. Bartner. Were they meeting with him, as Your Honor pointed out, were they meeting with him on a regular basis? Did they do multiple drafts of that purchase agreement and send them to him? How many telephone calls were there? All of that is discoverable because it may well lead to evidence from which a jury could conclude, you know, you were huddling up with your client for 60 days before this agreement was signed, and that tends to prove that maybe you were lending substantial assistance. So again, counsel keeps going back to how it's somehow irrelevant to the case. Half of our case is lending of substantial assistance. That's half of it, and it was ignored by the trial court. To answer your concern, Judge Johnson, you asked about the summary judgment. We included on page 31 of our brief a reference to the district court index, which has her ruling, and in that ruling, she noted, or she found her summary judgment as to aiding and abetting because she found that there had been insufficient evidence of any knowledge or participation, in her words, by Mr. Peters in this fraud. Well, now you get back to the same point. What is participation? Is it meetings? Is it phone calls? I don't think any litigant's hands should be tied in a case like this, especially a conspiracy case. To the extent that she tied them. That was clearly erroneous and especially egregious in light of the fact that a month later she dismisses the whole case because we didn't produce enough evidence of his participation. Those are all the comments I have unless you have questions. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion within 90 days as required by statute.